All right, we are in Isaiah, and Lord willing, we're going to do three chapters today. It's kind of hard on the women this time. Yeah, kind of hard on the women, but don't leave, ladies. Don't leave, ladies. So, let's get going. Oh, that's the timeline. You need to know your, everybody, you should know your timeline, right? You, the old Bible walkthrough was Abraham, I don't know, we went to Moses, we went to David, I think. Then we had the split, Assyrian, Babel captivity, to part of the Christ. There were 21 points on the timeline that we had to put together, and that was the best thing I ever learned, so that I make sure that I didn't get the cart before the horse. So anyway, that's our timeline this morning. And maybe I'll note it now before I forget to say it, that Isaiah writes from, let's say, just say 700 BC. Daniel writes by time you get to 540, maybe. I put, that's the last wave of the Exodus of Babylon. So after that. But anyway, one point is here that Isaiah writes without knowing Daniel. Okay, now that's important because we think of Daniel, I put it up here, well, we have Daniel, 70th week of Daniel, you know, got 483 years heavier. That was not in Isaiah's thinking. See, it's not against what Isaiah was saying, it's that the detail wasn't there. So Isaiah basically does his prophecy based on what he can see, and what he sees is judgment and restoration. The big subjects. Judgment and restoration. He doesn't see these details in here. Of course, doesn't see church. He doesn't see the 7 week of Daniel. For him, it's just judgment and restoration. And that's how he preaches, teaches, prophesies. Now, one thing that I'm going to make an executive decision about the judgments, they are sometimes hard to know what judgment is he talking about. In other words, is he talking about a near-time judgment, like maybe the Babylonian captivity, or some other judgment that's coming upon that generation, or is he talking about the far judgment? So the way I think you should do this, or the way I'm going to approach this, is that's always going to be the far judgment, unless there's a reason it can't be the far judgment. Now, that I say that because that'll really simplify a lot how you read Isaiah, because you tend to read Isaiah and you wonder, well, when is this going to happen? Well, when is this going to happen? Now, there may be reasons, and we haven't studied the whole book yet, that what is going to happen is obviously not this rest, this judgment. So then you'll have reasons to say it's not. But otherwise, if there's any doubt, then I think the judgments have to be these, what we call the final judgment or the tribulation judgments. That's what he's envisions. So that helped me a little bit to think about, you know, what will be caught between, which judgment are we talking about? Let's just assume that it's the far judgment and not the near judgment. All right, so those are the two things. Isaiah didn't know what Daniel was going to detail. And so how he does approach it, he basically approached it as one far judgment and one restoration judgment. Even though, well, you know, there really aren't any, if you think about Israel's history, there really aren't any restoration periods. I mean, Israel is always on the decline. And you say, well, boy, now they're really doing well. We had, you know, in the Judah, we had a couple of good kings, you know, a couple, three, four, whatever. But you can't go back to any time in Jewish history and say, boy, they got that together. Now they're cooking. Didn't happen. So if there is a restoration, it has to be at the end, rather than somewhere in between, and then it gets restored again at the end. Anyway, that's how I'm going to approach it, and if I see something else, I will point it out to you as we go along. What's wrong with that? So, as you know, how we're doing Isaiah, we're not going to do an Isaiah-like standalone study. This is a connected to Revelation study. In our last study, the Bible's a contract, we finished with a newly created heavens and earth is found in Revelation 21, 1. We made the observation that it mirrors the ending chapter of Isaiah 65, 17, 66, 22, and 2 Peter 3, 13. All of those use the same terms, and we match them up, and making this event for the kingdom, not after the kingdom. It has been noted that Isaiah is the apocalypse. The word means the destruction of the world. That's how the world uses it. We use it. Destruction of the world in the Old Testament and Revelation is the apocalypse of the new. So we have concluded that there is no new world, another world beyond the kingdom, that is beyond the 1,000. So I call it over here, eternity continues. I don't mean to suggest that there aren't any changes at all, but that the major changes have already been made here with the new heavens and the new earth. So what do we have here? We conclude that there's no new world beyond the kingdom revealed in the Old Testament. I think that's going to be confirmed. I don't think we have to wonder about that. So our intention is to confirm that hypothesis, and it remains a hypothesis in our study of Isaiah, which is a Jewish book with Jewish promises. And if you put the new heaven and new earth at the end of the kingdom, then you end up having a Gentile heaven rather than a Jewish one, and that seems to fly in the face of what the scripture teach for the Jews. Okay, now we talked a little bit about poetry last week. There is a richness that is derived from poetic expression. Maybe some of you try to write poetry. Isaiah is largely given in poetry, and it's there for a purpose. While rich in its expression, poetry can cause interpretive angst when figures or metaphors are used, and we'll get into those, I'm sure. But for the most part, its poetry has the benefit of compactness and inescapable, biting, stinging truth, which is in the hand of a skillful poet, the God of all revelation. If anybody can be a poet, God can be a poet. So we opened last week in a courtroom. It has the feel of a court where an indictment is brought against a defendant. Now, the defendant does not have the protections of our courts because the prosecutor knows all things perfectly. You only need one side here. There is no possibility of a miscarriage of justice in this court. There will be no mistakes made in the trial, which is a basis for appeals. By the way, did you know that's why trials are appealed? Because there are mistakes made, not because they disagree with the verdict. The verdict can never be challenged. It's what somebody did to get to the verdict that can be challenged. That's where the basis for appeals are. There will be no basis of appeals for these judgments because court was handled perfectly with full knowledge. So there are no defense witnesses called in the court because the charge is perfectly made by the prosecutor. Obviously, God is the prosecutor. If witnesses are present, they are on the prosecution side. Heaven and earth have been around since the beginning of the nation, actually longer than that, and they have a perfect vantage point to see it all. So we have two ways to look at this witness here. First of all, there's a witness to the charge. They are not called, but simply pose a threat. If they were to be called, they would support the charge. On the other hand, we have witness to the trial itself, and these witnesses, as history, have been recorded for us by Isaiah, as the court recorder putting into writing the proceedings. Isaiah functions as the court recorder. So in either case, heaven and earth are witnesses in two ways, in a sense. So our court is in session, and the charge will be common throughout the book, which is, they have revolted against me. They have revolted against me. That is a common charge. Said in a few words is probably possible. So I put this on the board, and I've walked through a little bit with you already. We've got Adam, flood, or Noah, and Abraham, the Mosaic Law. I put him there because that's sort of a new wrinkle. We have the Assyrian captivity, which is where Isaiah writes. We have the Babylonian captivity, is where Daniel writes. Then we have the period of time, we get to 586, is where they lose their national status. And we go into the intertestament period of, it's 300, well, I say 400 years, it's actually 330. We say 400 years. Then we have Christ. He institutes the church, which is not seen in the Old Testament. And the church has special blessings that are not revealed in the Old Testament. And one of the blessings is that it's going to be raptured out of the trouble that Jacob's going to have on the earth. So the church is raptured before all that starts. We're pre-mill, pre-trib. And then we have this expression, in that day or this day or that day, is an expression that is used in the Old Testament. Isaiah uses it, he introduces it. And it's the period of this judgment, which he doesn't, it's not defined. He just knows it as a judgment. He doesn't know it or doesn't say it. It's 7 years long. It doesn't need to have 7 years long in it. He just says it's judgment. That's fine. So until then, we have general judgments. I made a point of this. Don't know for sure whether these are references that he makes references to these general judgments. But we know for sure that we're safer on taking that they're the extent or the final judgment for the text, unless it's obviously otherwise. So during this time, there's just a general decline in Israel. Okay, then we have the second advent and the judgment of the earth's population. We have Matthew 25 where the Gentiles are judged, and then we have the restoration of the heavens and the earth for the kingdom, where have in it then the New Jerusalem. The king is crowned, the marriage of the Lamb, and we're supposing this is not metaphorical. I mean, it could be metaphorical, but it seems to be real, the marriage of the Lamb to the church. It's kind of hard to just imagine that. I don't know. So we'll have to find out how that's going to work out. Then we have the kingdom, lasts for 1,000 years, and then there's something happens there. We have a final rebellion. Satan is released, then the final rebellion. And the attack on God, and they're wiped out, and the fire that falls from heaven. And then nothing else is said about the kingdom after that, so we assume that's going to be like it was until that point. No reason to change it. So the national judgment is on the day of the Lord, and so that's it. And we have Isaiah writes here at the Assyrian captivity, and Isaiah writes of nearby or generational judgments or day of the Lord national judgments. And like I made that point. Sometimes we don't know for sure which it is, but we want to be aware that those are the choices. We ended last week with these two verses. One says that God, after he brings the indictment, God turns around like he does with Abraham and says, I will. So man's not going to do anything. God's going to have to do it. So God says, I will be relieved of my adversaries and avenge myself of my foes. I will do that. He mentioned that 3 or 4 times. On the other hand, we have God talking about man. The strong man will become tinder. He'll burn like a spark, and they will both burn together, and there will be none to quench them. So we have God will do his thing, and man will be destroyed. So that's in judgment. Now, we know there's always salvation of some that are saved because they have had faith in the God of creation, and that depends on exactly how they understood that. We could go down through history here. And we get to Christ, it becomes very clear what that content is. So the second chapter starts out like the first chapter, pretty much. It says, the word of Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. So we wonder, it says the word was seen. So, I mean, that's maybe just kind of a picture, metaphorical. You know, how did Isaiah see things? But, you know, it's as clear as seeing it. Whether he actually saw a picture of it doesn't matter. So the prophecy continues. Now, interesting how chapter 2 starts out as if it's starting over again, because we have the word which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. So that's like first chapter, verse 1. So we do not know how these prophecies actually were delivered. It would be reasonable that they were given in segments, like chapter 1 would have been a prophecy and it ended with a judgment and a statement about God's vindication and man's judgment. So we start chapter 2, some of the same pattern, but these don't necessarily follow chapter breaks. So we have this one here, I think, goes for three chapters. So it would be reasonable that they were given in segments, these prophecies, and were written down as we have them in the book. And this is supported by the repeated address given in room in both chapters, verse 1. Okay, the second thing to note, that the judgment against Judah and Jerusalem become more explicit and more sharp. And we are also given a clue about when these judgments will fall. We have now an expression that's going to be used, that's used 3 times even in this chapter, in the last days. And later on, chapter 13, verse 6, it says the day of the Lord. So the last days describes the day of the Lord. So the day of the Lord is in the last days. So they become synonymous in a sense. You could use them somewhat the same, because it always have the last days or the day of the Lord are the last days. Both make their appearance. Last days define the day of the Lord. And it is a technical expression for this period of time. There's a question a little bit about, I didn't put the rapture in here. I guess it's kind of important because church gets raptured before this. And the question is, when does the day of the Lord actually start? And we can argue about that. I have thought different ways about it, but I think mostly, I think the day of the Lord will start with the rapture, because the definition of the day of the Lord is when the Lord takes charge of things on the earth in a visible way. In other words, people will say God did this, you know, not like nature. You know, they realize that God is now doing something. And if he removes the believers from the earth in the rapture, if that isn't God doing something, we got to redefine the terms. Obviously, that's going to change the world immensely. And it's going to be indicated by the Spirit being removed from the world, and the world is going to have it at its own way. And when humanism will finally have its run on the course, so I would say that was the beginning of judgment, the day of the Lord. Well, this is how it goes, kind of sharp here. Now it will come about in the last days. We have the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and be raised above the hills, and the nations will stream to it. There's poetry there for you. So the mountain is expression of it's a figure of expression. I'll talk about this in a minute. And it's the chief mountain. I drew this on the map drawing over here, just kind of, obviously you can picture this in your own mind without that ugly drawing. So this mountain, the chief mountain, the highest mountain, will be established, and it will be raised above the other hills, and all the nations that are represented by these other hills will stream to it. So the switch, briefly, to a positive look of the future before we get into the judgment. So briefly, to a positive look at the future of Judea and Jerusalem as its national capital. And by the way, this is in the kingdom age. This is in this period out here. So he jumped over all of this to talk about this. The hope of Israel. Now, the use of high mountains to express supremacy is common in the Bible. The mountains are often named, used for expression of nations. This is the hope of Israel by a different metaphor. It was first given to Moses when Moses said to the children of Israel in Deuteronomy 28, before they're going into the land, he says, "The Lord will make you the head, not the tail." See, there's a different metaphor. Same idea, though. "And you will be above, and you will not be underneath." It's another metaphor. So we've got two in a row, and that's third. "If you listen to the commandments of the Lord your God, and I charge you today to observe them carefully." So we have the supremacy of Jews, which bothers the Gentiles immensely. They just cannot stand it, that the Jews would actually have some kind of supremacy. And they always charge them with the protocols of elders that they're going to take over the world because somehow this false idea has been placed in their mind. Well, it's not a false idea placed in their mind. It's what God has said. And as it is always with truth, it's a whole lot better to deal with the truth as it is rather than try to change it. So we have this supremacy of Israel. Again, we're talking about this period over here because it will never happen here. No matter how you worry about it or think that they're going to take over the banking system or whatever, it's not going to happen. Not to the point that they're going to be supreme over the world. That will happen when God makes the provision for them. So that comes out of Deuteronomy 28, and that is at the time when they go into the promised land. So it's 1,500 years before Christ that this promise is made. So the eternal kingdom passages, which going on this positive note here, and that many people will come basically to the Jews and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." So that's what I'm trying to picture here. I pictured the temple up here. And all these nations will now go towards Israel. Till now, till this time, all the nations flee from Israel. They're afraid. They're anti-Semitic. They hate them. But now, all of a sudden, it's to their benefit to be their friend or be a friend of a Jew. So many people come and say, "Come, let us go up to the Mount of the Lord, to the house of Jacob." This is a religious expression here, "that he may teach us concerning God's ways, that we may walk in God's paths." Now, these are the Gentiles saying this. That's not very common, is it, today? Uncommon. "For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." So in other words, the will of God will go forth. And I remember Jesus prayed his prayer, we call it the Lord's Prayer, says, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." That's what's being said here. It will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So we have next verse, "And he will judge between the nations and will render decisions for many people." Now, the question there is, he will judge between the nations. and rendered decisions for many people. I think there are two possibilities with that. From the bottom here, with judgment of the nations, Matthew 25, before you get into the kingdom, the nations are going to have to be judged. And they're judged based on their faithfulness to Christ, or, you know, as believers. And I don't want to go through how I did this some months ago, that seems like those nations that have highest percentages of believers in them, and you can measure these, I can't, but God can, that those will be more blessed and therefore get a higher reward as a nation than another one that has not been so responsive. So I think Matthew 25 is that judgment that divides them. And then the other one, it could be that the judgment goes on in the kingdom. And I don't know, we need to think here that there are bad things going on, that they have to be judged. This is just a matter of administration. And, you know, like what could be a good example? There's no good example. When my brother and I have an older brother who was 3 years older, and I have a younger brother 6 years younger. So I'm always identifying with my older brother because he was closer to us to an age. And when bananas were hard to get during the war, Mom would divide the banana. And then how we did this. One would cut and the other one would choose. That's how you did that. Well, see, there's no animosity, just something had to be said that would explain who's going to get what. No, you know what I'm saying here. So that's the kind of administration I think is going on here in the kingdom, because there has to be something said about you do this and you can do that, without it being a, you know, contention. There's no contention in the banana. It was only that I made the wrong choice. That was possible, but the system was fine, and it didn't indicate that there was something wrong with the banana or us. It was just a way of doing things. So that could be also what's said here. I'll read it again. So he'll judge between the nations, either at the beginning or and during the kingdom, and will render decisions for many people. So you have to decide where the boundaries are, the proper lines are, or responsibilities are. These have to be set. That's what you do with the administrators. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's an evil thing going on here. So then that's done. During this kingdom now, it says they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. What does that mean? Well, it seems like somehow war is not going to be waged anymore, because swords are useless as swords, but we can make plowshares out of them. And I'm sure this is all metaphorical expression, you know, that they're actually going to make plowshares out of them. I mean, if they did, it'd be okay, but probably is not what's being said here. So swords are made into plowshares. Plowshares produce something. Swords kill things. Not a good thing. And when they have out of these swords, we have with the spears, we have make pruning hooks out of them. I know you go fishing with them. It's a productive thing. And nation will not lift sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. And in light of the future, the Lord now says to them, come, house of Jacob, let us reason together. As we said in chapter 1, let us walk in the light of the Lord. So that would seem like that would be a good argument. They tell the people, do the right thing, because this is where you're going. Walk in the light of the Lord. But they don't. But they don't. Okay, so this expression here that we have here, the hammer and plowshares, it's a common one. It happens two other places in the Bible. One is in Micah 4:3, and he will judge between many people, rendering decisions for many distant nations. They will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. Now, maybe I might make some comment here, but a lot of prophecies say things alike, like this one. And it's not verbatim alike, but so you get an idea that maybe they did read each other in time, and the Lord would use these expressions again in another prophet. So if you're a scholar, it brings you nothing but angst, because they're trying to figure out which one was first, which one had the original idea, and who copied who. I say, when you believe in inspiration, we don't need to worry about those kind of details. You know, God can make these kind of these pieces of knowledge known individually, directly to each one, or they could have read each other. It doesn't matter, because God owns them all anyway. Now, we have a reversal here, which is really interesting. In Joel 3:10, it says, for instead of this period, we have this period of judgment. It says, now instead of being your plowshares, swords into plowshares, it's a plowshares into swords. In other words, get ready for a war. And your pruning hooks into spears, and let the weak say, I'm a mighty man. The idea that we're strong and we can go to war. That's this expression. It's getting ready for this judgment. So this has been a great football, so to speak, over the years, this plowshares thing. They always quote the one that's on the left, and they always fail to quote what's on the right. So plowshares for peace and war, misused verse, the United Nations. The sculptor born in Russia, of all places, does the sculpting work, and it was presented at the UN in 1958, all that long ago, and you get a little better picture of it. So he's actually beating a sword into a plowshare. I don't think very well done. He could have done a little better job with that, but that's what he shows. And the funny thing about this to me is, this is a Russian guy doing this. The Russian guy said, we're going to beat our plowshares and short swords into plowshares. So you always got to figure, how did this go again? Every time somebody says something, it's always the opposite, and we have that here. So the Russia now, magnanimous and this wonderful peace-loving nation is going to present this symbol of peace to the world, and they're attacking, driving the snot out of Ukraine right now. Where's the peace, Mr. Russia? Oh, well. All right, now. For you, that is talking about God, have abandoned your people. Okay, so now judgment's going to fall. For you have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with influences from the east, and they are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike bargains with the children of foreigners. I'm going to stop and go who all these people are. We could do that, but you understand, they got infected by their neighbors. Bad thing. Instead of being separate, they went into cahoots with them. And their land now is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures, and the land has also been filled with horses, and there's no end to the church. Now, this is a pretty time when Judah is very wealthy. And wealth always causes people to forget God. It's so easy to understand why that would be. Oh, I won't get into any kind of way we use our wealth, because that's all personal. But when people generally are wealthy, they generally move away from the Lord, because they can. They can have, a cottage in Hawaii and one in the Caribbean, and they can have jets that fly them there. Well, you can't do that and be in church at the same time. Well, they're just church, I mean, I can go wherever. You know how it goes. When you have money, you can do things. So, anyway, Judah is wealthy now, and they forget their God and depend on their good fortune. Now, it goes on with this judgment. The land is also filled with idols. They worship work of their hands, that which their fingers have made, so the common man has been humbled and the man of importance has been abased, but do not forgive them. So a day of reckoning is coming when man will be in terror of God. So this idea of idols, this is kind of a question a little bit about when is this for, because Judaism got rid of idols with the Babylonian captivity. They really are not subject to idols in our day. But it is very possible, from what it's going to say here, that they go back to idol worship in the tribulation, the day of the Lord. Otherwise, we have to have them this now fulfilled in that earlier time. That's why I say here's one of those things that you just don't know for sure what to do with it. And it doesn't matter a lot what you do with it, in any sense. But we've been told here that these are the shortcomings of Israel, and God will judge them, and when God does judge them, men will be in terror of God. So what will men do? Well, they will enter the rock and hide in the dust, the dirt, the ground, from the terror of the Lord, from the splendor of his majesty, the day of the Lord we're talking about here. The proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. See, in that day. That's, a technical word for the judgment day. God will be exalted in that day. So the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning. Again, I point to that day of the Lord, the day of the day of judgment, the day of tribulation, Daniel will call it. For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty and against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. And it will be against all the cedars. Now here we've got some metaphors again. Peter's people, or leaders are made out as trees, and it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon, all the lofty and lifted up, and against the oaks of Bashan, against the lofty mountains, and against the hills, they're all lifted up. So we have this poetic expression, and without naming names, we know exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about people that are haughty and leading the children of Israel in the wrong direction. So it's the day of the Lord, and this judgment will occur. So we have personifications there in cedars and oaks and hills and mountains. So against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and that's supposed to be an expression of the pleasure ships, maybe we call it cruise ships. I wouldn't get that from the word. That's what the commentary says. What is Tarshish? A lot of times we think it as Spain, but apparently it has to do with pleasure. So ships of pleasure take you someplace. I say like our cruise ships, maybe. So it's against all these vacationing rich aristocracy, and against all the beautiful craft. That would see the couplet here would sort of indicate that we're talking about a ship here, beautiful craft, a ship that would be for pleasure. And the pride of man will be humbled, and the lowliness of man will be abased. Loftiness of man will be abased, and God alone will be exalted in that day. Again, we're talking about the day of judgment. But the idols will completely vanish, and men will go to caves and rocks and holes and ground. And does that remind you a little bit of the book of Revelation? I didn't stop to bring those chapters in, but we are aware of that. And before the chair of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty, he will arise and make the earth tremble. And again, we have this expression of the earth trembling and the earth being involved in this judgment. And so this is during the time of the day of the Lord. So we have this repeated warning. So in that day, the men will cast away to the moles and their bats their offerings. I put that verse on the top there where it uses the same word, be gone, and you will defile your graven images laid with silver and your molten images plated with gold, and you will scatter them as an impure thing and say to them, be gone. You know, in other words, cast them away. Cast them to the animals, the creeping things. You don't care for them anymore. You throw them away to the molds and to the bats, the garbage, you might say. Because they're idols of silver and they're idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship as they run for cover. They really get rid of their idols. In order to go into the caves and the rocks and the clefts of the hills, clefts of the cliffs, before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he arises to make earth tremble. Again, we're talking tribulation language here. Therefore, because of all this bad stuff that's coming, stop regarding man whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? Is God's asking Israel that. So we have then the coming judgment, chapter 3 now. We've dealt with chapter 2. For behold, the Lord of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support and the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water. They're going to be isolated. They might be called seized. And the mighty man of valor, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, and the captain of 50, the honorable man, the counselor, and the expert artisan, the skillful enchanter, all going to be gone. I mean, the leadership is decimated here. And I will make mere lads their princes. The children will run this place because there's no one left. The rest of them will run away. The capricious children will rule over them, and the people will be oppressed, and each one by another, and each one by his neighbor, and the youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable. So we have a total upset here, what you might call anarchy, existing in this period of tribulation, because nothing is in place. And you read the book of the Revelation, you don't get all these details laid out for you, just sort of then this happens and this happens, but then you get into the details, you got to go to the Old Testament and see what's going to happen there. So the normal order of things is totally upset. So the children will run the place. In fact, it's going to be so bad that a man will lay hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, you have a cloak, you shall be our ruler. In other words, somebody in the house has one thing that he could call his own, and that sets him apart of all the rest. All he has is a coat. Since you've got the coat, you be the boss. And the ruins will be under your charge, he says. But the guy that has the coat says, he will protest, saying, I do not want to be your healer. For in my house there is neither bread nor coke. I can't help you. You should not appoint me ruler for your people. I mean, that's how bad it is. I mean, there's always somebody wants to rise up to be a leader. But in this case, there's nobody will rise up to take up the responsibilities. Now, why is all this happening? Because for Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen because their speech and their action are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. The expressions of their faces bear witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom, and they do not conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. And I got to thinking about visit Tel Aviv today, a gay city. Did you know that? I just, for your information, are getting a head start on this judgment. Known as the gay city, gay capital of the Middle East, that's Tel Aviv in Jerusalem, in Israel. Tel Aviv hosts one of the leading gay pride parades in the world, winning a worldwide survey conducted by Gay Cities Comp and American Airlines, of all things. Tel Aviv has voted the best gay travel destination in 2011. A Lonely Planet would put it, Tel Aviv is a modern sin city on the sea where there is more bars than synagogues. God is the DJ, I mean, this jockey, is that what that, I don't know what that DJ would be unless it's that. And everybody's body is a temple. It is a creative and open-minded, accepting and daring city. No wonder New York City named it Mediterranean Capital of Cool. So we think this is happening already now. It's going to happen then. Remember, all the restraints are off here. God is letting them go. And this is what happens when God lets go of man. Well, there's a stark contrast for the righteous. Say to the righteous that it will go well for them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions, Isaiah says. So this is going to go well for them. They get through this period, they'll be fine. And if they die through this period, they'll be fine because they'll be resurrected. So there's no bad story here for the righteous. But woe to the wicked, who it will go badly for him, for what he delivers will be done to him. Sorry, what he deserves will be done to him. Oh, my people, their oppressors are children. The oppressors are children, and the women rule over them. Oh, my people, those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your paths. I just think we have an interesting period of time. We have just come through where people have tried to manage life, and it's been through the COVID event that people out there in Washington and other places are expert people. And by the way, many of them are women who make these decisions for us, and we have to live with their decisions. Now, this is not against women. It's just the way women are. Women don't want to be run by women either. And that's not just a man thing. So it is a bad thing when women rule over the country. And that's what we have then, and it's going to be worse because the men won't do the work. You know, we already had the guy that had one coat, and he's not going to take it up, so the women will have to do it. Somehow they have motivation to do it. They've got families to take care of, so their motivation to do this. All right, so they will lead you astray, and they confuse the direction of your paths. And we've had such a confused world the last 2 years, and because somebody's been in charge of things they have nothing to do with. So the Lord arises to condemn and stands to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and the princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard, plundered the poor in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord. So these are things that they've done. I'm running out of time here. But you ladies will be just very glad that I'm running out of time. Because this is a list of all the things that you like to do with your faces and with your bodies and with your legs and with your charms and with your perfumes. So we have the hair, the beauty, the anklets, the headbands, the dangling earrings, and even the nose rings. I thought that was a new thing, but it's been back there already. The beauty of the anklets, the headbands, the crimson ornaments, and dangling goes on finger rings, nose rings, festal robes. Tunics to clubs, you know, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments. Oh, well, now we did it. All this stuff, you know, and they are judged for this because this is where their hope lies in. Now it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of a well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth, a branding instead of beauty. Your men will fall by the sword. You're even more destitute. You don't have any men take care of you. And your mighty ones in battle, and her gates will lament and mourn and desert her as she sits on the ground. I mean, that is about as low as you can get, sitting on the ground. That's why I never like to do snowboarding, because you always sit on the ground. It's humiliating. Now, real quick, chapter 4. For seven men will take hold of one man in that day. This is about the women here, how bad it is. I mean, you know, culture hits the women first. Because they have less resources, they have less strength, they have little, resources. For seven women will take hold of one man in that day, And they said to this one man, we will eat our own bread, we will wear our own clothes, we're not going to ask you of anything, just let me be called your wife. And I'll share you with six other women, just so long as I have a name, and maybe with is connected, having children. I don't know if they're thinking about that, but children, women that don't have children are bad shape as far as the women are concerned, so they need a man to have children. So they'll share this man with six other women. So the destitution of the women will be so severe, they will be willing to share a man with six other women. They will not expect support, just restored honor, because they don't want to, they no longer want to be just called the street people. So in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. The fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. It will come about that who is left in Zion remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone is recorded for life in Jerusalem. This is good stuff. In that day, the branch of the Lord, that's the Shekinah glory, has come back. When the Lord has washed away the filth, the daughters of Zion purged the bloodstream of Jerusalem in her midst, and the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. And the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke and brightness, and a flame of fire by night. This is all reminiscent of the Exodus. For over all the glory will be a canopy. There will be a shelter to give shade and heat by day, and refuge protection from the storm and rain. Now, I just got to say a little bit about that storm and rain. We're in the kingdom here, so I think that we want to think about that a little bit here. Can I skip this here? I want to go to what I said. Fugenbaum is saying that basically the shine of glory will come back, which makes sense because they come back with the second coming of the Lord. Okay, let's go. We're going to go about here. The Shekinah glory will be over all and provide a sheltering canopy. So resulting in a special protection from harsh conditions, heat, storm, rain. Now, we're in the kingdom, and those kind of conditions really don't exist in the kingdom. You know, you're not really going to starve to death. You're not going to get sunburned. You're not going to get, you know, flooded. So why are these expressions here? So my answer to that is these natural events are likely metaphorical or anachronistic. Or anachronisms? Say the words out of time. Since there are no threats like these in the kingdom, the Bible says that. So the kingdom itself is the protection from these natural events of judgment. All of which have passed. The judgment have passed. It is a comfort for us to know, who still live under the curse, to know that we, the kingdom dwellers, will not face heat, rain, storm, lightning, thunder, tornadoes, or tsunamis. That's, I think, the point is being made here. So the Messianic kingdom is the major theme of the book of Isaiah. The much more will be learned about it from this prophet. Okay, I'm going to have to stop here. I've got a great warning close here for you, but you don't need to be warned about the judgment, do you? Or do you? Well, imagine, this warning is now 700 plus 200, 2,000 years old. This warning Isaiah is giving us. No wonder people say, as they did 2,000 years ago, where's the promise of his coming? Everything's been the way it's always been. Where are you talking about the Lord's coming? Well, the Lord may be slow, but he's never late. The day of salvation is still here. The day of the Lord is a day of judgment. The wise will get oil for their lamps before the shout of the bridegroom, Matthew 25. Those who devour, drowse, and sleep are unprepared when the bridegroom comes, and I will say, I never knew you. Ooh, you will be sent to where will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All right. It's a terrible thing to fall in the hands of an angry God, and that's what awaits those that do not trust Christ.